Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Demonstrations and protests have been held in American cities large and small around the country since George Floyd died after a Minneapolis police officer held Floyd down in the street with a knee to his neck 10 days ago. Some of the protests against police brutality and racial injustice have turned violent and led to destruction of property and looting. Police in those cities have tried to contain the violence and restore order, and state National Guards have been called in to assist in more than 25 states. Earlier this week, President Trump said he may go further.
Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or a state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
The president's suggestion to use active military troops in a domestic disturbance would require implementation of the 200-year-old Insurrection Act. So when can a president use the military on American soil against Americans, and is there a precedent in history? Joining us on today's program is retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Professor Bert Tussing, director of the Homeland Defense and Security Issues Group at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Professor Tussing, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Lieutenant Colonel, can the president use the military to respond to domestic unrest?
Well, the president can, Scott. As you know, there is historical precedent. You've already referred to the Insurrection Act. However, as I trust you also know, the utilization of the military in a law enforcement function is antithetical to the way we think as a people and the way we practice as a military. We here in the United States have got a very pronounced, if you will, distinction between those two components that society has granted kinetic force. One is our law enforcement and one is the military. And the way we do those things is decidedly separate. So what I would remind everyone right at the beginning of our discussion is that we as a people want our soldiers to be soldiers and our policemen to be policemen. And we want our military to remain our servant and not our overseer. So whenever you see the military applied in any civil circumstance, not just law enforcement, but in any civil circumstance, the military is there in support of the law enforcement entities. So even when the president declares the Insurrection Act, which has been done historically, as you know, when he does so, he does it placing the military under the federal control of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. So that helps us to begin the discussion. Let's go on from there.
Okay. Well, one thing that you just mentioned, and it is one of the key parts of this discussion, and that is in support of the civilian law enforcement or civilian government. Isn't it true, though, that for the military to take a leading role in law enforcement, martial law would have to be declared?
Well, yes, that's exactly right. For the military to take the lead would constitute martial law. But remember, too, that martial law hasn't been declared in this country since 1863 when President Lincoln did it in association with things going on in the Civil War. And even that was struck down by his Supreme Court. So this would be highly, highly, highly out of the norm, because basically our philosophy is if there is civil authority standing, then the military remains in support. Now, if civil authority, particularly, and this, as you probably also know, is part of the Insurrection Act, generally speaking, the Insurrection Act isn't invoked until civil authorities have requested it. Even the president doesn't normally invoke the Insurrection Act until a request has come from a state's legislature, or if the state hasn't been, the legislature isn't convened, then the state's governor. And that hasn't been done, of course, since, and 1992 was the last time it was done, with the L.A. riots at the behest of the governor of California, and then the execution by President George Herbert Walker Bush. And then prior to that, in 1989, in the aftermath of Hurricane Hugo in the Virgin Islands, when authorities there at the Virgin Islands requested that the president invoke the Insurrection Act.
I want to take a step backwards before we talk about the Insurrection Act. What is Posse Comitatus? It's the Posse Comitatus Act, and the Insurrection Act is part of that. But what is Posse Comitatus?
Posse Comitatus, Scott, is a law also that came out of the Civil War times. It was brought on the books in 1878, and basically it sets the ethos that we're talking about here. It says that the active component of the military, and we'll get back to the distinction there is in a section, in a second, but it says that the active component of the military may not take a direct law enforcement role. That means it cannot interdict, it cannot arrest, it cannot apprehend, it cannot search and seize, it cannot stop and frisk, it cannot interrogate, it cannot surveil, it cannot collect evidence even. We basically say that if a law enforcement function is regulatory or prescriptive or compulsory, our active component of the military cannot do it unless, as we're talking about here, the Insurrection Act is invoked. And I cannot emphasize in our discussion here how rare it is that the Insurrection Act is invoked.
So, again, in that step back, you explain Posse Comitatus, but the Insurrection Act is part of that, is under the Posse Comitatus Act. What exactly does the Insurrection Act say?
Well, the Insurrection Act, Scott, basically, you're talking about three different circumstances. The first and the last two times that I described to you that the Insurrection Act was invoked came upon an occasion where a state and local government's activities or properties, or most importantly, its citizenry, has been taken under threat, and the constabulary forces were beyond not their capabilities but their capacities within those capabilities. And at that point, as I said, either the state legislature or the governor, in those cases where the state legislature is not in session, he can request to the president that the president invoke the Insurrection Act. The second circumstance is if a federal entity is under threat, if there is an attack against federal utilities or federal installations or direct opposition against federal agencies or forces, if you will, and then the president can declare an Insurrection Act. And then the final instance is one that you may recall, you and I having probably being close to the same age. The final instance is when a certain element of our citizenry is the rights of those citizens are being endangered or withheld, or those special elements of our citizens are being endangered, and either the state government, state and local government, cannot or has elected to not protect those special citizens. And the last time we saw that that sort of thing invoked, or one of the last times we saw that sort of thing invoked, was back in the early 1960s when citizens were being not allowed to enter into universities, at that point I would point out that the president federalized the governor's National Guard. They became federal forces at that point, and they at that point invoked the laws and ended the quote-unquote insurrection. I would say too that the Insurrection Act, that's the name of the act, but it's almost prejudicial because it implies that any time that the act is being activated, it is due to an insurrection, which I think is probably too harsh a word, but But then again, I'm not a lawyer, so don't tie me.
Well, that I think the history does have something to do with that. When you say that, you know, this derives from the Civil War, which was an insurrection. You know, some of those historic precedents you were talking about, President Kennedy did in the early 60s, you know, federalized National Guard. President Eisenhower in the 1950s, also with when citizens were being attacked, black citizens were being attacked here in the United States. But I just want to clarify, I want to make sure that everyone understands what we're talking about here. When President Trump says that he will send in federal military troops that to put down some of the unrest in these situations in these cities across the country, he cannot do that unless he has been requested to by a governor or by a mayor or by the legislature in that state, unless federal property is being jeopardized. Am I reading that correctly?
For the most part, you're reading that correctly. But remember, too, if federal installations, once again, if for instance, someone were to attack a federal building, then the president has the authority of invoking the Insurrection Act on his own authority. Or if, and this is probably where we get into a little bit of interpretation, which I frankly am not qualified to do too much in way of interpretation, but if the president were to deem the states unwilling to provide for the proper protection of its citizenry or its resources, then I suppose the interpretation could be that the president could invoke the Insurrection Act. But once again, that is one of the three sections of the act that I talked about. The remaining section, by the way, Scott, is one where the president has to offer a proclamation of disperse and retire peaceably to the riotous forces, personnel, I suppose you would say, before he can invoke the act as well. So there are distinctions here. There are steps here that have got to be taken.
So, yeah, just to clarify, the president would have to say to, not personally, but there would have to be some order given to those people that are you know, causing the problems, the unrest, that they, okay, you have to disperse now or we're going to call in the military, right?
Well, you have to disperse now or we're going to call in the federal military. Now, one of the other really, really important distinctions I don't want people to lose here, Scott, and I know you know this, is that the National Guard is probably, in my mind, the most important military that we're talking about here, because the National Guard is 98% of the time the direct tool of the governor to invoke when he or she sees a situation that is perhaps getting beyond the capacity of our regular forces, whether we're talking about law enforcement issues right here, or whether we're talking about response to natural disasters or things like that. So the National Guard is a very important part of our military that we're talking about here that is far more commonly associated with these types of activities than you would see of the active component.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. During this portion of the program, we're talking about President Trump suggesting earlier this week that he may use the U.S. military, the federal troops, to put down some of the violence that has occurred in American cities as the result of protests over the George Floyd killing. Joining us is an expert on this topic, retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Professor Bert Tussing. He's director of the Homeland Defense and Security Issues Group at the U.S. Army War College's Center for Strategic Leadership and Development in Carlisle, an instructor at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Albert. Albert, you're on the air.
Hi. We just kind of actually sounds like we just started talking about this. I'm a JAG attorney with the National Guard, and I wanted to just – I see a lot of confusion on social media and a lot of confusion with people about the National Guard's role versus what we call the big army's role and what kind of – you know, with regard to posse comitatus, what authority a National Guard soldier would have as opposed to, let's say, an active duty soldier. And, you know, we're dealing with things – what we call Title 10 versus Title 32 status. If we could just flesh that out a little more, because I do think I see a lot of confusion with people about what roles, powers, and responsibilities a National Guard soldier has versus, let's say, an active soldier.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. It sounds like Albert's in the car. But Lieutenant Colonel, what about that? You just started to touch about the role of the National Guard. How is it different than federal troops?
Well, Scott, I want to keep Albert close by because he is a lawyer and he can keep me from the thing. but basically, when we think about the National Guard, it is a strange and wonderful beast, and I love the Guard myself. But the National Guard can be activated, most often it's activated as a direct tool of the governor of his or her state or territory. We have 54 different National Guards across the United States. And as I said, under state active duty status, they can respond to the governor's direction. Now, the interesting thing about that is, under those authorities, under the governor's direction, he can grant them direct law enforcement authority. So the Guard itself has a greater propensity, potentially, to help in these areas than the active component does.
So just, can I interrupt for just a moment? So you're saying that the Guard could make arrest, could collect evidence?
As directed by the governor, yes, they have that direct assistance capability that is prohibited from the active component.
Does that occur very often?
No, it does not. It does not, for the very same reasons that we talked about earlier. We train our soldiers, our sailors, our Marines, in a way to respond on a battlefield that is not what a policeman is trained to do. I've frequently used this analogy with my own students, but if a Marine or a soldier is on the battlefield and they're starting to lift their weapon, then they better have an idea of exactly what they want to do with that weapon in immediate implementation. Okay, a policeman, on the other hand, is going through a series of decisions from the time that they are thinking about unholstering their weapon. And that is only right that it be that way. So because of that background, because of that mentality, we have a very distinct separation between what we call rules of engagement on the battlefield, having to do with utilization of weapons, and rules for the use of force in if you will, in a domestic environment. And that's why, for the most part, the military is wildly reticent about employing its forces, especially its forces under arm. You may recall back in our response to Hurricane Katrina, for instance, when gracious, going brain dead here for just a second. when the general who I know well, and suddenly I've lost his name, but he was on the streets of New Orleans, screaming for his soldiers to put their weapons down, because that in and of itself promotes a message that we want people to understand, that those people are there in support of the citizenry, in support of the civil authorities, and in this case, in support of civilian law enforcement agencies and civilian law enforcement authorities.
When you just mentioned something that is very important, and
Honore was the general's name.
Okay. Rules of engagement.
Yes, sir.
Who decides what the rules of engagement are, whether it's the National Guard or if there are federal troops in an American city?
Well, when you're talking about this, we're not talking about rules of engagement. We're talking about rules for the use of force. And those things are distinct. And frankly, they are frequently drawn up for the situation at hand. Many times you will see National Guard members who are in support of civilian law enforcement agencies that will be out on the streets. You saw this, for instance, Democratic and Republican national conventions. You saw this with the Pope's visit. The Guard is out on the street to help with things, but they're completely unarmed. They don't even have weapons with them. Other times, you will see the forces employed with other types of restrictions all along the way, because we want to maintain that distinction, and we don't want to put our soldiers, our Marines, our sailors, our airmen, in a situation which puts them unnecessarily in jeopardy over the decisions that have to be made. You know, when we apply the military writ large, we usually have what I refer to as a mission assessment criteria. And we look at it first in terms of legality, then we look at it in terms of lethality, then we look at it in terms of risk to our soldiers. We look at terms, and finally, it gets right down to the question of appropriateness. It may be legal, but it's still a question of, is this appropriate? And that is frequently a decision that has to be made by the commanders on the site.
Earlier this week, the Secretary of Defense Esper used the term battle space. Now, he walked that back a little bit and said that that's a term used in the military, but it took a lot of people by surprise because it sounded as if the protesters, even, you know, those who have been committing violent acts and looting, that those people were the enemy. When you heard the word battle space, what did you think?
Well, I would never want to be an official like Secretary Esper or anyone at that distinction, because every word can be interpreted, and I'm quite sure that the Secretary wanted to walk that one back as soon as he could, because what he was thinking was, well, I don't know what he was thinking, but the interpretation that came out of that utilization of that term at that moment is the one that we're talking about here right now, which I suspect was not his intention.
Hmm. Let's take a phone call from Norman in Lancaster. Norman, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. The scenario, if a National Guard has been called out by a local governor, the president could allege that federal property is being vandalized. He then could make a proclamation saying that the people who are allegedly vandalizing the property would have to leave. He then could go to the Attorney General and call out the federal troops. Question is, in that scenario, we have a National Guard controlled by the governor. We have federal troops controlled by Barr or the president. Would there be a standoff or a conflict between those two groups?
Wow. Norman, I hate to even think of that, but is that even in the realm of possibility, Lieutenant Colonel?
I doubt it very, very seriously, Norm. That's an interesting postulation, but what we have arrived at here recently in dealing with major disasters is, generally speaking, what we will do when we are responding to the needs of an area, we will put Title 10 active component forces under the control of the National Guard. We have what we call now a dual status commander, because the accepted interpretation is nobody knows the state or the territory better in uniform than the National Guard. And remember, what we're always doing here is supporting civil authorities. And the National Guard, more often than not, has already established relationships, not only in terms of process, but in terms of personal relationship with many of those authorities, which becomes very, very important in discussions like this one. So I would, of course, we pray that we never see these types of activities, but I would not be overly surprised at all to not see that dual status commander authority that I'm talking about here that we've utilized in major disasters incorporated in this type of activity, because in reality, in all reality, at the end of the day, as I've said from the beginning, what we're doing here is not supplanting, but supporting civil authorities. We are augmenting the capabilities that they have. That's why they're calling in the military in disaster response, and in this case, in law enforcement type activities. But even then, as the requests are being made, we are staying as much as possible out of a direct assistance type of role.
George, listener George has an email, says, would the armed occupation of a federal facility qualify as an event for the Insurrection Act?
Not immediately. I would not think. It certainly would allow the president the authorities under the act the way we've discussed it here, but I do not know that would mean an immediate implication because of the sensitivities involved here.
And
these
we have
our citizens after all.
Well, you just brought something up before I ask this next question from a listener. You know, you can't speak for everyone, but you did talk about the military's role and the responsibilities they have accepted. Would there be soldiers, would there be Marines, would there be naval personnel who would say, I am not going to arrest our fellow citizens. I am not going to go into battle, if you will. And I don't want to use that word. I'm using that as a metaphor as opposed to a literal sense, that they do not want to have to arrest or face off against other American citizens.
Well, Scott, at this point, you're asking me to speculate on something which I think would be dangerous at best. But the processes that we've talked about here, the ethos that we've already talked about here, should make it pretty clear that this is, if ever in the history of the world, there was, if I may use Lincoln's phrase, there was a military, an all-volunteer force that was so definitively of the people, by the people, and therefore definitively for the people. It's this one. And the military's leadership is reflective of that as well.
Mm. When you hear there have been a number of former military, and I mean high-ranking military, General Mattis, former Secretary of Defense, four former Joint Chiefs of Staff chairmen that have criticized the president this week, that is highly unusual, isn't it?
In my personal experience, that's highly unusual, yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, we often, because the War College is local, and we often have guests from the U.S. Army War College, and, you know, from the very beginning, you know, when I say very beginning, when I first started hosting this show, you know, I was made aware that the President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief, and very often, like never, does someone in the military criticize the Commander-in-Chief? So now it does say something that these are retired military as opposed to active duty military, which, again, that is something that probably wouldn't occur. Now, that question from a listener that we received earlier related to the other one, asking whether landmarks in Washington, D.C. would qualify as federal property that the president could invoke the Insurrection Act.
I believe under the strict interpretation of the act that, yes, that's true.
Mm. Let's
find too, though, Scott, let me not interrupt you, but the District of Columbia also has a National Guard, which is the only thing that you have seen on the streets in the military's uniform of Washington to this point.
And we have an email from Kid, and this is more of a comment than a question. He says, the thought of our president using the U.S. Armed Services to police the general population of the United States, I find it very unsettling. I'm beginning to believe our president hasn't pulled the trigger on using the military to control our citizens because he's still unsure of democracy's fringes. An election is coming this fall, and I'm sure he's aware of the stakes if the perception of his leadership goes south. Again, that is a comment more than it is a question. So, Lieutenant Colonel, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program. I want to thank you very much for being with us here. So we as citizens of the United States, what should we be looking for? What, I don't know whether we can ask what to expect, but what should we be looking for when the president says that he may utilize federal troops?
Well, Scott, as we've already pointed out here, there's an awful lot of ground between that observation and the actual implementation of the observation. Historically, as we have said, this has not occurred many times at all. And the other thing that I would point out is when it has been invoked, the first thing that the military has in mind is what is needed to return the duly constituted authorities to their correct position, or to basically to leave law enforcement to law enforcement officials. The military is, once again, the servant of the people, not their overseer. And that is something that was drummed into me from day one, 1975, and it is something that we continue to talk daily about with the leadership that we are proud to instruct here at the Army War College.
I just want to clarify something. You used the word constituted, and I'm going to take that one step further, one syllable further. Constitutional. You have touched on a lot of these things, but would it be constitutional for the president? I mean, the Insurrection Act is there, the Posse Comitatus Act is there, but what's constitutional, what's not for use of military?
Well, sir, keep in mind, please, that the Insurrection Act, the Posse Comitatus Act, were both acts, laws, that were passed by the United States Congress. I don't need to do a civics lesson here, but the laws, the authorities that have been invoked by Congress are executed by the executive branch. So what we have talked about here, remember, these are worst-case scenarios that we are talking about historically. And this is not something that I would think of as would be a flippantly administered in any circumstance.
I want to thank our guest for being with us today, retired U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Professor Bert Tussing. He's director of the Homeland Defense and Security Issues Group at the U.S. Army War College's Center for Strategic Leadership and Development in Carlisle. Lieutenant Colonel Tussing, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday Smart Talk, we're going to be talking with at least one member, maybe more than one, of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus about some reforms, policing reforms that have been around for a while. I know that Governor Wolf actually had some suggestions yesterday, some proposals yesterday, but these are proposals that have been around for a while about policing reform. We'll be talking about that. Also about HIPAA. A lot of people have confusion about what's private when you're talking about a medical condition, and it does relate to, there are some anecdotes and some stories having to do with the coronavirus where HIPAA has been invoked. We'll be talking about that as well. If you are working from home due to pandemic restrictions, your commute is probably what you missed the least. An article published in the May issue of National Geographic magazine gives hope to commuters everywhere that their post-pandemic travel might be very different. Joining us is the author of that article, journalist Emily Sohn. She's a National Geographic contributor. By the way, her article will be found at natgeo.com/coronavirus. Ms. Sohn, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So what prompted writing this article?
Well, Nat Geo has been doing a series of stories on kind of reemerging and looking to the future. You know, obviously, we're still in the midst of this pandemic, and nobody knows how far off that future is. But because we're all facing such unprecedented changes in our daily lives, the idea was to sort of just look ahead and you know, take an issue like our commutes, which have changed for many of us, and think about how might that be different based on this crisis and what we might learn from it and all the challenges and opportunities that it presents.
Who did you speak to for the article?
I talked to a handful of public transportation experts, urban planners, people who, you know, this was a new topic to me, but it turned out there are people who spend their whole careers thinking about transportation and really analyzing situations like this where they face public transit systems face challenges and cities face challenges, and looking at how they respond, what they do right, what they do wrong, and what they could do better in the future.
Now, we'll talk about the commute and what it could look like in the future in just a moment or so. But one of the things that you mentioned, and actually it's at the end of your article, is that there could be no commute at all for more and more Americans. I am hearing from a lot of people who said that their employers were hesitant to embrace work from home, who have changed their minds now, and that it may become permanent. Do we know how widespread that will be?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a topic for a long time, right? And people have been speculating about this, I think, ever since the internet kind of came around. But but businesses have been hesitant, and that seems to really be changing. The Brookings Institution did a survey in April, which is now ages ago. But at that point, half of adults in the United States were working from home, and it was about 20% of chief financial officers said they would retain remote work for their, I think, at least 20% of their workers into the future. So that's a pretty significant number of people who might just stay home and continue staying home.
Is it significant enough that the average commuter would notice a difference, say, on buses, trains, or cars on the highway?
I think it could be. I mean, we've been seeing that already as it is, you know, that in many places traffic is so much lighter than normal. One thing I heard from my sources was that there might also be a hybrid model that emerges, so people might realize they can work from home much of the time and then come in for essential meetings. So like, say, once a week or midday, you come in and meet people you need to meet. And so I think that really could reduce crowding on buses and trains and traffic on highways if it really does stick around.
Let's talk about those buses and trains. Much of your article is focused on public transit. What will buses and trains look like once, I almost hesitate to say once the pandemic is over, but once things start looking a little bit more normal and people are going back to work?
Yeah, I know what you mean about not wanting to use the word normal, and I think this is an event that's likely to have an impact on all of us for a long time to come. It's still unclear. I mean, the funny thing about trying to write an article where you predict the future is that nobody can do it, and you know, nobody even really wanted to speculate that much. But it's also an opportunity to kind of look at where we are and what potential we have and what the possibilities are. And so, like, what we do know is that public transportation is in a really rough position right now. The numbers are way down, as much as, you know, 90% or more in some cities. And we also know that often, like, humans just kind of go back to their normal ways when they can. We really are creatures of habit and want to do things the easy way. And so there is a possibility that people might just kind of reach a point where they feel safe again, and they, if they have that choice, will just take it again, as opposed to many people who don't have a choice and are still riding. But there are some really interesting possibilities for at least finding ways to reduce infectious disease risk by, you know, using technologies and strategies that we already have in place in many places to reduce crowding and reduce the amount of stuff that people touch, to have people pay in advance or book their seats in advance, or, you know, figure out which car is the least crowded and get on that one, for cities to track where people are and where the demand is greatest and respond in real time. So some of it might look really different and some of it might not look that different at all. It sort of depends on probably on the city and where the pandemic goes.
Well, several things you just mentioned there. The technology, for the most part, already exists. Are you saying that the people you talk to think that it could be utilized more widespread, an app, for example, that where you would get your seat ahead of time, find out which car on a train had the fewest people, or where you could be furthest away from a person, or, you know, someone who wants a window seat, you know, something like that, that technology exists now, but would be more widespread?
Yeah, when I first started researching this, the technology piece was initially one of the most interesting aspects to me, and I was expecting to find all this really futuristic stuff, and there was some of that, but there also was really just this whole category of technologies that already exist, that we already use in other contexts, or that some cities are using, that really could just make a big dent in some of this kind of crowding type stuff. So in some cities in China, for example, pre-booking even on just your daily trains is already really common. So that's something we could do, right, where we could spread people out a little bit more by saying this train is full and you've got your seat reserved on it. I think some of it we're seeing in stores already, where we protect the driver. We have some kind of plexiglass and ventilation so that they're not interacting with the airflow of the rest of the vehicle. People, you know, some of the recommendations I've been seeing on city websites are, and what they're doing is, you know, we're really trying to minimize interaction between both people and people and the driver. And so you've got people coming in the back of the bus. And I think some cities have made buses free for now, but in the future, you could imagine you just pay on your phone, or you pay before you leave home, or, you know, if you can, you use a smart card or your Apple Pay to just get on there. And then there are these really cool apps. We use them in Google Maps already, or Waze, you know, these apps where you can tell where traffic is the heaviest on highways when you're driving and go the other way. Well, why can't buses and trains use that too? And one idea would be to use that kind of technology to help you actually pick the bus you want to get on based on how crowded it is.
What about COVID-proofing public transit? Because, as you said, there will be a lot of people that we are creatures of habit that will fall right back into their old habits once they do return to work. But the buses and trains themselves may look different. In what way?
Well, I mean, we talked about isolating the driver. I mean, spacing people out. You could imagine simple things like hand sanitizer everywhere. There are cities where 10 people's temperatures were being taken automatically or by other people with, you know, thermometers being held up. So you could imagine having to walk through almost like a metal detector and be denied access if you have a high temperature. You know, I know that some cities are cleaning, simply just cleaning more, closing a little longer and sanitizing their trains overnight. So stuff like that could be like slightly different and not that different, things that we're sort of getting used to just having around these days anyway.
Let's take a phone call from Brett in Lancaster. Brett, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for letting me on.
Yes.
I'm a vehicle damage appraiser, and I've been seeing a lot more since the coronavirus of the insurance companies pushing the people to take pictures of the damage. And this is very unsafe. I have actually last year pulled a couple cars off the road that the insurance companies were safe to drive, and they weren't. Things like broken springs, other damage underneath that, somebody physically looking at it. And we can inspect the cars without getting close enough to the people to have any real interaction. You know, outside of hello, and is this your right information? And just warn people that don't do the pictures. That either take it to a body shop for an estimate, or tell the insurance company to send somebody out to look at it.
All right, Brett, thank you very much for your call. I think that's just Brett providing a little bit of advice here for those who do commute by car. You know, we are learning a whole lot more, again, during this pandemic about some of the ways that we handle things in a normal situation. In your article, though, you do talk about the health impacts of commuting via public transit or riding a bicycle versus using cars. Talk about that a little bit, and then I have a few questions about that.
Yeah, I found this so interesting that there is this real balance between infectious disease risk, which is what is on everybody's mind right now, and chronic disease risk, which has been around in a problem for quite a while. There really is strong evidence that you ride mass transit. The whole point of it is to move masses of people together. You're exposed to more people, and not just more people, but you're really, if you're in a busier station, you're around people more for longer periods of time. You're much more likely to get illnesses, respiratory diseases. But then, you know, for many people who have a choice, the reaction is either stay home and work there if you can, or get in your car if you have one. And that's not necessarily solving all your problems, because other research has shown that, you know, every extra hour that people sit in their car each day raises the risk of obesity by 6%. And then obesity is a predictor of chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease, which actually put you at higher risk of COVID. So it's this really complicated interplay between wanting to strike that balance of living in a way that you're moving your body, you're walking to the bus station, or you're hopping on your bike to bike to work if you can, and getting that kind of movement in as opposed to sitting in your car as a reaction to not wanting to be exposed to disease.
Are urban planners thinking that way, though?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's been a huge increase in both bike lanes and streets being closed to traffic during the pandemic, just to help, in many places, to just help people spread out, but to kind of push people to get on their bikes more. There's also been, it seems, an uptick in e-bikes, and a lot of cities have electronic bikes. And so I'm really interested to see whether some of this stuff sticks around, whether people are going to be biking more, getting on e-bikes more, finding ways to get to work without going on public transportation or getting in a car. And it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out in all of this.
In your article, and the people you talked to said it will take investment. And by that, obviously, we're talking about money. And this economy has just been ravaged by the pandemic. So where does that money come from? I mean, we've been talking for years now about, I mean, both Republicans, Democrats, everyone agrees that we need an infrastructure upgrade, but we just can't find a way to agree to it or a way to pay for it. So how do you find the money for the kind of investment you're talking about here?
It's such a good question, and nobody had an answer to that specifically for now. But I will say that considering some of the stimulus money that we have now, and thinking about investment by cities and federal government as well, it's likely going to be worth it if they can find that money, because, you know, looking at 2008, where public transport after recession, public transportation really went downhill then too. It sort of led to this downward spiral where cities didn't have the money and didn't invest in public transportation, and people stopped riding even as employment went up and unemployment went down and people were getting to work. There was an opportunity there that was really missed, and the experts I spoke with were really hoping that we could learn a lesson from that and invest, because it will pay off. I mean, I think it was Seattle where the city actually did invest in more bus service and ridership went up. If we could be forward thinking and think long term and make that investment, it could really benefit our cities in so many ways into the future.
Journalist Emily Sohn, National Geographic contributor. Her article can be found on natgeo.com/coronavirus. Hey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. Great talking with you.
Coming up on Monday's program, we talk about proposed police reforms in Pennsylvania, also about HIPAA privacy laws. That's coming up on Monday's program, so be sure to tune in.